Hey, welcome to Optimize Your Body with Martin Silva, where we talk raw, uncut facts to truly help you optimize your body.
Hello, guys. So, I've got Alicia Gowan. It's been a strong week, and I'm finishing this week off on fire. So, how are you doing, Alicia?
I'm really, really good, and thank you so much for having me. The weather in Sydney has not turned it on, however, but otherwise I'm really happy to be here.
Yeah, good stuff. The weather's not quite as good as what it is up where you're from. No, it's been slipping a bit, hasn't it?
It's definitely not. We landed here and straight into rain, and it's been raining ever since. I'm like, oh my gosh. I walk everywhere, so walking from the Darling Harbour across to the EHP studio, it's just like, oh my God, I'm getting drenched.
Getting drenched. It's just unpredictable. We haven't had any rain for ages here, and then it just obviously pours down. But
you did it just for me.
So I was going to say, tell us what you're doing down in Sydney at the moment anyway.
Look, I'm in Sydney twice a month, every single month. I obviously here with work, with clients, but also for my specialist team, which I know that, you know, we've bantered about before on my podcast. Mm-hmm. I've got a specialist team based in Sydney that basically look after the rehabilitation of my back post my injury. And I work with them, you know, sort of twice a month, and it keeps me in check en route to the world stage. As you know, I'm preparing for that. I'm 9 weeks out on Saturday, which is very exciting.
Wow.
And you know, staying on top of this has been very important because we've started to do squats and deads again, which is something that I was told I would never do ever again for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've started being able to do that as of December last year, progressively getting better across the course of this year. And it's been amazing. And these guys just keep me all together in one piece, pretty much. So
that's incredible.
So I'm here with them, and then here with the EHP Labs. So I spend a fair bit of time at the headquarters here whenever we're down in Sydney. We do a lot of reporting, a lot of work with the team over some of the stuff in the gym. We go through instructional videos, some workouts, and then just talk shop on all things sups and health and nutrition, really.
Mm. Oh, awesome. Yeah, so you've got an injury now. Before we go into your injury, we'll talk about that because I'm intrigued, especially about the squat and deadlift thing. The fact that you're back on the king and queen of all exercises.
Yeah.
That should be interesting, the response you get. But no, if you could just share with us exactly your story and your background, Alicia, if you could.
Yeah, sure. So I am the current and two-time WBFF World Fitness Champion. I have a long-standing history in competing. And, you know, look, I took it very seriously when I started the world of bodybuilding and decided that the WBFF from day one was where I was going. Everything about them, the physiques, the shape, the glitz, the glamour, you know, I love the fact that everything about that brand screams health and fitness. You know, the finishes on stage and the physiques that we present on stage, they're not emaciated. They're not, you know, dieted hard. They look like you just walked off the beach or out of the gym and stepped straight on stage. And that was always really enticing for me. You know, the fact that I could live my lifestyle and something I was passionate about instead of having to fit inside of a box really excited me. So I took it so seriously, though, the tagline of the best, that I, went out and became Miss Fitness Australia for IMBA first and then competed overseas for that federation before finally having the WBFF come to the Australian shores. And I was part of the very first Australian, you know, the very first Australian show, which was very exciting. Got my pro card here on Australian soil, which surprised me because I really thought I'd probably have to be achieving that overseas. And I had been prepping for the LA show before they, you know, announced and I got an invite to attend the one here. And so that's it. It's been WBFF all in for me.
Wow.
I eat, breathe, sleep, and I feel it's on repeat. But
But
I love everything about it. And, you know, this will be coming into my 6 years as a pro, you know, the first 2 years for me coming from an amateur into a pro level of competing. It was such a shift, you know, going from being, you know, I guess quite developed and profiled here to them being a small goldfish in a very large ocean. And having to, you know, I guess progress my physique and bring something, you know, such another level. You have to level up. So for me, you know, the whole process for the first 2 years was all about finding where I sat, finding where my physique was requiring, you know, more work, and then really just getting back to the drawing board in the gym. But it was in the second year as a pro and post, you know, my second Worlds that I actually sustained the injury that I had, which is what I'm still sort of rehabilitating from at this point in time. I broke my back in a squat, it was a devastating injury.
Broke your back?
Broken. Pars fractures, like,
oh my days. You must have been shifting some weight, yeah?
You know what? I was actually, because it was only 2 weeks post, as you know, you come out of a show and, you know, look, you are it takes time. It takes time. Like, you're compromised. You know, your body's been at its lowest level of body fat. You've been, you know, over-dieted, over-trained. You're coming out the back end of it. And me being me, I was like, yeah, no, I'm just going to go straight back into the gym because I don't know how to take time off. And look, I just think that it was just probably a myriad of factors, and it all culminated to a perfect storm that day. And I was tight in the adductor and in my warm-up round. So I was only, it was only 60 kilos on my back, and it was my warm-up weight. Perfect form, so there was nothing in that regard. I just had the adductor pulled tight, and basically I had a rotation on my hip. So on the right side, my hip rotated forward. My piriformis locked on my left side. My hips just basically rotated forwards, backwards like that. And under the pressure at the bottom range of the squat, you could hear the crack across the room. It
was, oh, my
days. And I just dropped the barbell, and my girlfriend that was in the gym with me at the time was like, are you okay? And I'm like, I'm just on the ground. I couldn't talk. I couldn't move. I'm like, no.
Oh, my.
Christos was teasing me for, and even to this day, it's a running joke that I should have played basketball that day because the boys are all in the gym playing ball. And I decided, no, I'm definitely going to go squat. Went with my girlfriend and instead walk. Actually, I couldn't even walk. She was like carrying me into the room where he was to say, I think we've done something.
Oh, my days. What bone did you actually break there?
So
what bones
L4,
did you break?
My L4, L5.
Wow.
So it was pars fractures in my L4, L5.
That's crazy.
But it wasn't just that. You know, that would have been nice if it was just that because, you know, obviously fractures heal. What happened, though, was I ended up with a multi-tiered bilateral bulging disc structure. So basically both sides out of the L4, L5, L5 down to S1 it was. So it was all of them out both sides and into my nerve roots.
Ouch.
So it was...
That's got to be painful.
Absolutely horrendous. Mm. So, you know, look, for the next 3 years, up until December, just gone, I lived with, you know, daily chronic pain. So it was an extremely difficult journey because, you know, in that time, obviously, as you know, I was rehabilitating, coming back to stage, and I was winning titles, you know. So to the outside world, I guess, for a lot of people, they had no idea what was actually going on. Ended up getting to the point where I started to share my journey, you know, quite openly on public sort of forums because I was having a lot of people that were really resonating with the fact that, you know, look, lower back pain and I guess back issues as a whole are pretty common for people. They're nowhere near the extent of what I had had, right? Mm. But I guess it gave people hope to watch the ability for me to rehabilitate what I had rehabilitated and still be able to achieve these things. So the irony of it is that I was achieving all these things with no squats and no deads because I'd been told when I did the injury that I'd never be able to squat and deadlift again because of, you know, how severe it was. And vertically loading basically was out. So I went, oh, well, I'm fine. I'm going to get there without that. And I basically did everything I could around it to still make it a stage and still, you know, achieve a winning
position. Wow, so you actually worked around a broken back, essentially. Obviously, it was repairing, but there's only so much, you know, it can sometimes, that's kind of irreversible. Some of the damage you could do there, obviously you can repair it because you're, you know, you're fit and strong. But, you know, to a certain extent, like, that is tough to repair, right? So
It took so much time. And then it's one of those situations where, you know, look, for the first sort of 2 years post, you know, doing it, it's the disc issues that were actually ongoing. So, you know, like, God, Martin, just even sneezing or coughing would be a massive issue for me. So I'd get a cold and I'd automatically go into anxiety attacks because I'd be like, oh my God,
because you know
I'm
the pain's coming. Agony.
I'm going to pop this out again. And so that's exactly what happened to me 17 weeks out from Last Worlds. We're on the plane flight home. You're in a seated position. Everything's contracted. So everything's, you know, it's not optimal for you, right? And I had bronchitis that I'd gotten while we were away and sneezed and coughed and blew another disc out. And so from 17 weeks out, I was unable
How
to...
How many weeks out? Seven.
17,
yeah.
So,
but even so, at that point, you're pretty much getting ready to go in deep,
exactly.
Right?
So that's when, you know, most of the time your workload's increasing. You're saying, you know, your hypertrophy's there. Mm. You're starting to maybe include, you know, small amounts of cardio at that point in time, or at least not far off it.
Mm.
I couldn't do any cardio at all the whole way through. Like, we were literally walking, but I could only walk so far because the pelvis would basically rotate and put more pressure on my disc. But then I couldn't even pose until the night before my show because at midnight,
the night before your show,
I'm working out my routine in my room, my hotel room, because I couldn't get any rotation and I wasn't getting to put my heels on because I might throw the back out. And I'm like, I just need to get to stage.
Yeah, so how did you get on that particular show?
I won it.
Oh, that was the one. That was the one.
The second title just gone.
Oh, really? Yeah. That was the one just gone. So that was the most recent show.
Most recent show.
Jeez, but I'd like to just talk a little bit more about what you said about, you know, competing with the Delhi BFF.
Yeah.
Because for me, that was just a game changer. Just as you said as well.
Yes.
Oh yeah, definitely. I was in a similar boat in terms of I competed with UK BFF.
Yes.
Who is familiar. Yeah, like the IFBB. It's the same thing. It's just like the branch off there. Anyway, and the shows were just rubbish shows, you know what I mean? They were just so unorganized. The atmosphere was dead. And then I didn't get where I wanted to get anyway. Long story short, I did like four or five shows and I just wasn't getting there. So I thought, right, Delhi BFF, people were saying, you know, you'll do well. And then my first Delhi BFF show just blew me away. You know, yeah. I think I came second. I just missed out on that pro card. And then 6 months later, I went and won the London one and then got the pro card. But it's just such an incredibly entertaining, like, exhilarating experience, isn't it? Win or lose. Obviously, I mean, I don't know. I'd like to win, but I think you'd have a good experience either way, right?
You do. You really do. And look, I think that's probably a few different reasons for that too. You know, it's the fact that it really is an expression of your own personality and individuality, right? So you look at other brands and there's a very routine. Everyone looks the same. Everyone's going to wear the similar sort of trunks or, you know, outfits, you know, bikinis. It's all basic. And then you all have the exact same pose, the exact same thing, right? Whereas within the WBFF, it's about bringing your best, showcasing your strengths, mitigating any weaknesses you've got, but really it's your flair. So you can get out and pose however you want. You can bring your entire expression to that stage. And then in that, what I love is that gives you an opportunity to be picked up and, you know, for marketability reasons by, you know, commercial organizations as a representative or an ambassador or a sponsored athlete, perhaps, because of your personality and what you're presenting on stage. So, you know, there's so much scope in, you know, I think having a career in fitness with your, you know, ability to compete with the WBFF. But then also on top of that, it's the way they look after their athletes, you know. Like, it's a show, it's a production. It's like, you know, everyone's there to see you. You're the main event. And so it's just not like anything else, you know, the lights, the show, that from registration night alone.
Yeah, exactly. When you turn up, that really gets you going. Exactly. Then I can remember that first ever registration.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, I don't know anywhere else that you rock up to registration like you would to an Oscars.
Exactly. Red carpet. Literally, it is. Like, they think we're exaggerating, but you've got red carpet. Right, you're dressed. I think that's the smartest I've ever dressed.
Exactly right. And the funny thing is, you go, take me out of the brand. And they're rocking up in track pants and thongs.
Yeah, that's it. I know. Everyone's just looking grumpy and the vibes are just dead, like at the Federation, do you know what I mean? But yeah, it's a spectacle, isn't it? It's definitely a spectacle.
It really is.
I just wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, you're doing a show. You're obviously doing the World Championship. I didn't realize it was that close, actually. Yeah, nine weeks away.
9 weeks out on Saturday. So
wow.
I know, right?
Yeah. I know. So, I was just going to say, yeah, in terms of your prep for that now, so talk to us a little. I'll go into my prep a little bit after you've talked about yours, but I wanted to get, you know, a little bit more detail on, like, where you're at now, because you've had all this experience now competing. Have you ever actually done a Worlds before?
This will be my...
Obviously, you've done a Worlds. What am I talking about? I should have done my research. fifth Worlds. Fifth. Okay, then. All right. Sorry about that. So anyway, this is your fifth Worlds then, right? So talk to us a little bit about your prep and how that's gone. And I'd like you to talk a little bit about, you're starting squats and deadlift soon as well. But any insight you've got for the listeners would be great.
I think the game changer for me on this prep has been the fact that we actually could squat and deadlift again. Because, you know, as I said, we worked around every other variable, from blood flow restriction training to basically just working with bands, like, you name it, we did it with the most basic of stuff to rehabilitate, right? And now that I've got full movement, free range, and you know, no longer suffering from this chronic pain every day, I've actually got the ability to start loading vertically. So putting squats and deads into the mix meant that I could do, you know, really good hybrid training. So we've been able to do a blend of, you know, aesthetic-based bodybuilding, hypertrophy, then, you know, I'm bringing in the compounds and some powerlifting-based movement. So it makes it enjoyable and fun, and it makes it not so boring. So, you know, the first part of prep looked like that. Now we're moving into the stage where it's definitely moving into, you know, volume-based training or hypertrophy. It's looking at conditioning. It's looking at the final tweaks now on the physique and the areas we're trying to bring up. And obviously, you know, now it's about peeling back the layers.
Yes,
and the final layers, and you start going into that, you know, fun deficit.
So you mean peeling back the layers of body fat, just for the listeners.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's where you have a situation like I did the other day, where I look at my half a cup of oats in the bowl and I put it back into the measuring cup and I shake it because I thought there must be air in it and there wasn't enough oats in the bowl. And I put it in the bowl and I'm like, oh my God, that really is a half a cup.
You're like, literally,
I look at Chris and I went, That's literally a teaspoon.
Mm.
I don't even want
to. You should really use a teaspoon to eat it, shouldn't you? You should get a teaspoon and eat it really slowly, because otherwise it's like three mouthfuls.
Otherwise it's gone. You inhale it and it's over. It's like one breath. It's exactly. So bad. Wow. So that's, you know, I guess that's the stuff that you start to get to at this point. You know, you start to have your calorie cut. Your sort of first sort of cut for me came about 3 weeks ago. And it's a real adjustment at first, you know, especially when, for me, this prep has been different because I've been able to do the big lifts. I've kept my calories much higher. So I've been able to cruise in up until only 3 weeks ago for my first cut, which has been amazing. I've been really happy with that because it means that, you know, my output in the gym, my intensity in my sessions, my ability to keep pushing.
Maximize.
Yeah, the ability to maximize my conditioning through the application of the training as opposed to starvation has just been, oh my God, so much better.
Incredible. So in terms of cardiovascular then, you haven't actually had to do a great deal of cardiovascular training, just movement. And I wanted to talk about that as well because I feel like for some reason, it's almost like a kind of just like a thing for bodybuilders and bikini models to do cardio a lot of the time, like really far out from comp. And even when they're kind of like off season and stuff, they're still doing cardio, especially women. I don't find it as much with men, but I never really understand the logic behind that, because like your body adapts when you're doing cardio in a way which is not ideally favorable. So for me personally, leading up to my shows in like, I think 16, 17 weeks now, so I'm not planning on doing any cardio at all. So it's just going to be, and that's what I've done for the last show. I was literally just walking. And as you know, nutrition and weight training, when you get that right with the calorie deficit and whatnot, you can achieve it really without cardio, right? Yeah. But what would you say, I don't know, talk to us a little bit more about cardio and that kind of stuff in terms of getting in shape for a show.
I think that a lot of people fall in the trap of using cardio as a way to mitigate food choices. Do you know what I mean? Like, I actually think that for a lot of women, especially when you talk about the off-season component, I think that it's that fear of letting go of the stage physique. And then I think it's also because they want to be having their, you know, cake and eat it too almost.
Mm-hmm.
And then they think that cardio is going to be the magic, you know, magic pill. And it doesn't really work that way, because you're right. We get a level of adaptation that happens for, you know, the output. So the more that you're doing, the more the body's going to adapt to that. Not only that, you're increasing your inflammatory markers, and you're also increasing cortisol. So you start having this, you know, laws of diminishing return. There's only so much that's actually good for you, and then it starts actually, you know, peeling back on the benefit.
Mm.
Actually, there's research on it. I can't quote, you know, what that one was, but, you know, I'll find it later and send it to you.
Yeah, great.
But it was actually research around step count and actually the point within the law of diminishing return actually kicking in. And I believe that the numbers were around the 12K mark, the sort of around that mark, you could jump up, you know, in sort of brackets for a period of time, but then you're best off stepping back. So almost like you do with a diet break on nutrition, you know, going through the hypercaloric and then having that little diet break does the same sort of thing. So, you know, maybe jumping up and then peeling those steps back so that you actually give the body the ability to, you know, rest and recuperate, and you also aren't hitting that point of the bell curve when then you're coming back down the other side and it's in diminishing return, because it does happen.
Yep.
So I'm a big believer like you that cardio should be used as a tool in the final stages, or maybe just to crisp something up.
Yeah.
And maybe if you are nursing an injury and you can't necessarily push as intensely or get out the volume inside the gym in your sessions. And look, and I also feel the same way about, you know, not removing carbohydrates as well, because it's the same deal. You want to be able to keep an element of carbohydrates in to fuel those lifts, because those lifts are what's going to actually tighten and, you know, reduce your body fat more so than just relying on a cardiovascular basis, because, you know, you're right, you adapt to that.
Absolutely, yeah. And I was just going to say about weight training as well and stuff. So just trying to relate to the average person, right? So just with where you're at now. So I guess at this point now, you're 9 weeks out. How long ago did you start cutting? And just for the audience, you know, cutting is when you're trying to get leaner and lose body fat and achieve a calorie deficit.
So probably 3 weeks ago, we took the first cut down. And we're maintaining that now for at least the next probably week or two.
Yep.
In that time frame, though, obviously from now through to stage, it's a little bit different to the normal sort of lifestyle programming, in the sense where, you know, your resting metabolic rate is going to adjust as your body fat levels adjust, and you know, as the tissue drops and there's thermogenic, you know, the thermogenesis basically reduces as a result of that. Then we've got to start modifying the nutrition component, because you can need less, right? And so, you know, you start to see those things happen, but you try not to make too many adjustments, and you try to look at, you know, other factors. It's like the two sides of the coin. You can make an adjustment on nutrition, you can make an adjustment on training. You don't want to make an adjustment on both at the same time as much as you can. And so for me, you know, at the moment, we've made the adjustment on the nutrition that now sort of, you know, flat lines for a couple of weeks, and we're going to adjust what we're doing, we've increased output on the other side of the coin with the training and the volume. So, you know, walking the chocolates, and the chocolates are my dogs, Crunchy and Cadbury. We walk the chocolates every morning.
You serious?
No,
oh, wow. Serious. I thought you were messing around there.
I have a toy caboodle, and I have a mini dachshund, and they are both little chocolate-colored, little beautiful little things. And so on my daily habit tracker, which this is something interesting, I think, for everyone that's listening, success really is bred, I believe, through the application of daily habits and rituals, right? That's how you get through days where you're waning in motivation or energy, or, you know, you're just literally at a point where, you know, maybe you've got to dig deep, especially in this prep process. Trust me, there's a lot of those moments. So, you know, I find that having those habitual rituals really prevents you from falling out of that. And it really makes sure you tick all the boxes. So for me, I've got an app on my phone. There's a habit tracker, an everyday habit tracker. And the very first habit when you open it is walk chocolates.
I'm surprised you haven't eaten your dogs even at the shows.
I said a message one day, and it was one of my coaches on my team. They're like, what are you doing? I said, walking chocolates. And he thought I said walking for chocolate. And he goes, don't you mean chicken and broccoli? And I'm like, no.
He thinks you're going to slip up.
That is not my dog's name. So walking chocolates is the first thing. And, you know, look, that's the only cardio we do at the moment. And that's, you know, look, it's how I start my day. Mm. It's for the health of my animals more than anything else.
And your mind as well. Let's just talk about what it does for your mind and your energy levels, just movement. And, like, the people who have the best longevity and the healthiest lives generally tend to not do crazy cardio. They just generally tend to walk more and move more, right? So that's important for overall wellness as well, right?
Exactly. Sure? Totally is. And, look, I think, you know, the first thing in the morning doing a walk like that with the puppies also gives me the time to get, you know, a little bit of either clarity around my day. You know, I'll either put on a good podcast while I'm walking and listen to something that's, you know, nurturing, you know, my journey and adding value to me, or I'll be having a conversation with my fiance, you know, connecting in. So, you know, I use it for a point for me to be able to be out in the sunshine. So the circadian rhythms are in check, you know, I'm getting the blood flow moving. I'm actually starting to, you know, function for my day, but I'm also then looking at, you know, planning for my day, either I'll be mentally ticking boxes or I'm listening to something or I'm having, you know, a relationship connection, because I find that, you know, if you are disconnected from anything in life, and that's a disconnect from, you know, your business, your work, your family, your partner, I find that success is really hard to get.
100%. It's a massive pillar of health, isn't it? I always talk about the four pillars of health, and people forget about the relationships and the social side.
They so do. So in the prep process in particular, it's the biggest thing that I think, you know, can bring people undone, is they all of a sudden start feeling disconnected, to their family. And you know what? This is the other thing that I always say. It doesn't have to be about food, you know? Yeah. Like, a connection is literally just making time for someone. A connection is basically having a conversation with someone that makes them feel like they're important to you, you're important to them.
Yeah, like a meaningful interaction kind of thing.
And, you know, look, if it's going to be your goal to be at a composition on stage to be judged in that capacity, then connect over that too. You know, maybe take your partner to the gym, take your partner, you know, on your walks, you know, get them involved in the process. You know, and I'm really great. I've got a great support network. My family is really involved in my process. They've, you know, supported me my whole career. And my fiance is amazing. So, you know, we walking the chocolates and walking my fiance is like what I do in the morning. It's the only cardio. And then I think, look, in the next probably week or two, I will incorporate 3 sessions a week of like post weights hit. And it will literally be like 5-10 minutes max, but it'll be at a max heart rate level. So I'll wear my heart rate monitor and I'll make sure that I'm in a, trust me, if you've ever done it.
Yes, thanks. I'm glad you talked about this.
This is ridiculous. Like true. Yeah.
People don't do it right, do they? 80% of people, 90%.
It's like nothing. People think it's
How long do you see? Because I'll do that as well. I tell a lie. On my last show, I did actually throw HIIT in. It's a tool I do use occasionally. I threw HIIT in at the end because HIIT has so many benefits. But obviously, it's one of those things where it is what it says it is, right? It's high intensity and it does take its toll on your nervous system and metabolism. But talk to us a little bit more about that. So you'll throw HIIT in at what point towards the end, did you say? Just to ramp it up?
In the next 2 weeks.
Okay.
Have me in about like 8 weeks out.
And it's kind of an experiment then as well, isn't it?
Correct.
Right? See how you respond.
It also allows me to be ready early so that then we can literally carb into show, right? So
when you say carb into show, you mean you can just kind of like, you can allow yourself to have more calories in general
I will taper back on the training, reduce the inflammation and increase the nutrition, in particular my carbohydrates, just to basically fill everything out. Because if you're in the right level of condition, you can do that. You're not chasing, you know, body fat reduction all the way through, and you're not doing these drastic, aggressive, you know, cardiovascular strategies at the end, where then you just fried. You know, your central nervous system is fried. your cortisol's raised, like you're not sleeping and you're wondering why, like all those things start to happen. So no, like that whole concept of more being more is so such a myth, you know. Less is more a lot of the time.
Glad you said that.
And so, you know, I think getting people to understand that two sides of the coin, you've got to give from one to take from the other. But you know, it's really
something's got to give, isn't it, at some point? Yeah, definitely.
Got to think about like those, you know, those scales you see, you know, the balancing of the scales. It's really much like that. You know, you've got to make sure that I prioritize sleep and recovery over everything else. Sleep is my number one thing. I make sure that I'm in bed at a reasonable hour, and if I'm not, I make sure I give myself a sleep in the morning. I don't push the early start if I haven't had my 7 to 8 hours. I monitor all of my data with my Oura ring and check, you know, heart rate variability and how things are tracking for me, because it shows me quite a lot. And then I just prioritize my morning rituals that include, you know, like walking the dog and getting my day started, but also I do some, you know, meditation, some gratitude journaling, because they really do set you up for the day. It's what I call my PNS inputs, so my parasympathetic nervous system inputs, which then help to, you know, calm your central nervous system. I mean, when you think about it, we're putting ourselves in our central nervous system under duress every single day, daily activity. Even just getting caught in traffic in your car can get your heart rate elevated, everything pumping.
And just driving in general. Exactly. And people don't realize that's a mild stressor, right? But yeah, exactly. and I'm glad you said that, because about gratitude, you know, that's when it's a chance for you to either, you know, the gratitude and meditation comes in handy, because it's like, I can either sit here and whinge and shout at the people and over a situation I can't change and get stressed out, or I can just sit here and look at it as a chance to have a bit of, you know what I mean? I know it sounds a bit, but do you find that?
It's cliche, but it's very true. And there's no, you can't get any benefit out of getting upset and worked up over someone else's either actions you can't control or a situation that's out of your realm, you know what I mean? So I find that these little things that you do that help feed that central nervous system and calm everything down, especially when you're in a position for prep where you're constantly putting your body under stress and duress. You're constantly, you know, inflaming it with your workload and your training schedules. And then you're actually starving it technically.
Yeah, that's right.
In constant stress. Because your
body, let's talk a little bit more about that actually, because like just for the listeners, your body doesn't want to be there, right? When you're doing a prep for a show, there's one thing like, you can look at a guy on a beach who's about maybe like 10% body fat, and you can look, you know, people can look and go, wow, that he's in incredible shape. Look at the shape on him, right? Yeah. But if you got on stage, you get nowhere. You get like laughed at, right?
Yeah, exactly. Because
a guy on stage has to be, you know, under 6% minimum, right?
Yeah, it's crazy.
And the same goes for a woman, right? So a woman could be like, let's just say 17-18% on the beach and look insane on a stage, get blown away, right? Yeah. So talk a little bit more about that, because people don't, I think a lot of people don't quite realize, it's growing still, right? It's competitive game.
Look, I guess the analogy I always talk about with my team too is that it's like climbing to Everest, right? You can climb to base camp and you can live there, and it's uncomfortable and it's still, you know, a little dangerous, but it's not as dangerous as climbing to the summit, right? So I say that, you know, for people that are in prep, and this is when, you know, you take the girl off the beach and then you put her into a prep process to get her ready for a condition and prime for a condition for stage. And this is why it's important you can't live at stage lean ongoing. And, you know, hopefully this analogy will make sense to everyone as to why. Because the conditions on the physique and the body and the way the body wants to hold its set point, it does not want to get that lean. It's not safe for it, right? It's there to be able to reproduce. We limit our, you know, reproductive environment when we start playing with these things at these really low levels of body fat. So basically we've climbed to, you know, base camp and we're chilling there, and that's kind of, you know, partway through the prep process. And I would say you're still sort of at campsite 4 until probably about 6 weeks out from stage. And then from 6 weeks through to stage day, you are literally taking that to the summit climb, and it is treacherous. There are so many things that can go wrong. It's really, you know, quite taxing on your health. It's going to be so, you know, demanding on you physically, mentally, emotionally. That is prep. That's the final 6 weeks. You hit stage. Stage is the moment you put your flag at the top of the summit and you get your picture. And then guess what happens? As soon as stage is over, you get the hell down. You climb back down, you reverse out of that stage, you get to campsite 4, and that's probably about week 4 after stage. You gain a little bit, you're starting to find an element of homeostasis starting to come back, your body's starting to recover. We call it a recovery phase a lot of the time because it really legitimately is. And then you acclimatize and start, you know, descending down to, you know, the rest of reality and the rest of the planet. But that's really, you know, what a prep process looks like. It's incredibly taxing, and it's a journey that will challenge you on every level. And it is something where you cannot live at that level of stage lean. That subpar levels of percentage of body fat, we're not designed to sit at that all year round. You know, the body will do everything it can in its power to become more efficient, compensatory level of efficiency 100%. Too. So then you get that adaptation on so many levels, and basically it's like going up to your furnace. If you think about your metabolism like a big raging fire and throwing water on it.
Yeah, and just killing it. And that's talking about cardio, because that is essentially what happens with cardio, right? Is if you're doing it all the time, you're sending a signal to the body, it gets efficient at actually burning calories, but the rest of metabolism will then slow down to compensate, because you're telling the body, let's get good at burning calories manually. Whereas when you lift weights and build muscle and build metabolism, you're automatically burning more calories. So you're
correct.
So that's but I love that analogy about Everest. And what I wanted to say was about, you know, character building, because talking about like lifting weights and training in general, right? It's so black and white. That's what I love about training, is, you know, you're consistent, you put the discipline in, you know, you put the work in, should I say, and you get results. It's black and white, and it builds your character. So obviously you build a body. That's like, as I said on your podcast, it's like a byproduct of good health and taking care of yourself.
It really is.
But how would you describe that? Because obviously, just at the start of your journey, firstly, how long have you been lifting weights for?
Oh, 18 years.
18 years.
Yeah,
longer than me by 2 years. Damn.
And I fell into it, you know, everyone listening, I fell into it because it was actually, I was a prima donna ballerina. So 44 kilos ringing wet when I started bodybuilding. And I fell into the love of weights and weight training because I actually had an injury and I was rehabilitating the injury. And
from sport? Was that from playing sport?
It was actually from ballet. So,
yeah, okay.
You know, and this will probably give you insight too into why the back went for me later in life. I had a hairline stress fracture at that time. So I had a predisposition. I had some weakness in that lower back from, you know, from the age of 18.
And you probably had excessive range of motion, but not the strength.
Hyper-flexibility, in that motion. So hyper range.
Yeah.
And so
you had the strength, but you know what I mean? Like,
so that's what happened. It was about creating, you know, the infrastructure that supported those, you know, mechanisms, and in particular, you know, my hips, my lower back, and you know, create strength in the stabilizers. That's what I had to go do. So anyway, in doing it, I just honestly fell in love with this process that I saw this return on quite quickly, because it was a very new response. So it was a new stimulus. Whenever you're going into the gym, you've never lifted weights before, you're going to grow. And I'm very jealous of all of you out there right now, way faster than I would, because you know, you get that first time.
Oh, it's incredible. That response you get at the start.
Oh my gosh. Right.
Yeah, unbelievable.
You grow like a weed. It's amazing to watch. And so I had that, and that is addictive. It's like, honestly, it's like a drug. Like, you're just like, you're hooked.
The results are just so addictive, aren't they? Yeah, and it's happened so fast. The results are so significant at the start, right? But
absolutely.
So it was because of an injury. So you started doing it to build strength and maybe mobility or whatever it was to rehab the injury. But were you driven at the start of this process? Like, what was the main driver? When you said you started getting addicted to the results and started, you know, chasing it and enjoying it more, were you more addicted to the physical side of it in terms of how you looked or how you felt, or was it a combination of the two?
Probably definitely a combination of the two, I think. You know, like, I think more than anything, I got hooked on the numbers that were able to be increased over time with strength-based, you know, and performance-based goals, more so for physical. And then I guess, you know, out of that then, you know, you really start to see your shape changing. I'd absolutely say that there was a lot more confidence that comes once you sort of feel like you have this, you know, far more enhanced physique, and you really do. You know, back when I started, it was in that era of, you know, flat bums were best and everyone was skinny, and, you know, seriously, like, skinny jeans were the thing that was in. Now I look at everything and I'm like, unless it's a pair of Freddies that can mold over these quads, I'm not even interested. And if I think I've lost an inch off my ass, I'm crying.
Exactly. I love that the day and age we're in now.
Please tell me my butt looks big in this, because if you don't, I'll probably backhand you.
It's amazing how it's changed now, and like, sustainable health and kind of like health is almost becoming cool now, which is great.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, look, I guess, you know, for me, sport was always a massive thing. So I was never not in that realm. But moving into a space where, you know, you were changing your physique outside of the norm too, I was probably always a little bit anti-conformist. So it was probably a little bit of that as well. But yeah, I love that. I loved the thickening of the physique in different ways that, you know, the sports I was playing wasn't necessarily, you know, going to do that. You know, my sport was really slighter frame type stuff. So this was really outside the box, but I loved it. And once I knew I couldn't dance anymore, that was it. You know, I had to pursue something else. And I just, threw everything I had, heart and soul into it.
Yeah.
And I've never looked back. You know, look, I went on to open up several small performance facilities over the course of the time that I was still in corporate. So I actually went to university, did my degrees and my master's in corporate and in business. I had still been pursuing and studying this and had this as my hobby business on the side, but I've done this my whole life, you know. I just decided finally when it was, and it's funny you said that about how, you know, fitness is becoming a more mainstream thing and it's becoming the cool thing, right? When I identified that it actually had a market that was definitely not something to be laughed at anymore, that was the day that I decided that I could go into my hobby business full time without being laughed at. Because for the first, you know, sort of 6 years that my business, which is nearly 12 years old now, this entity that I'm working in, for the first 6 years of its life, I didn't put it on any of my social platforms, and I never wrote that I had it on my LinkedIn because I just didn't think I'd get taken seriously in the corporate world for having those interests and or having those businesses. I thought I'd be laughed at. Whereas now, I feel like I laugh at anything you know, that I did previously in the corporate world. But I'm like, man, you couldn't put me in that rat race and those three-piece suits and stockings anymore because I just couldn't live that lifestyle anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
But,
it's not something you're passionate about.
No, that's exactly right. I just was not as passionate about it at all. And, you know, for me, when you could see that this was, you know, something that I could step into and actually really start to make a difference in, then there was no looking back. I had to go into this full time, you know.
Yeah. Have you done personal training as well? And have you done like one-to-one stuff?
Yeah. Look, I did that for a lot of my earlier career. I worked for Fitness First only 12 years.
There we go. That's why I wanted to come to you because what I wanted to talk about, I'm glad you said that. I wanted to double check that just in case I shot you down because what I've found is like more and more people, everyone's an online coach now. Every Tom, Dick and Harry now, right? Dishing out nutrition. They do one show and dishing out nutrition, you know, plans and stuff. But the way I've looked at it is like, I personally think unless you've been training people for at least I would say 4 or 5 years, you have no place being an online coach, right?
Correct. It's because you need to be able to deal with the nuances of the client on the floor. You need to be able to have, you know, a really keen eye too for picking up, you know, biomechanical imbalances and just things that might not be moving properly in their lifts.
Yes,
you'll pick it up just by looking at them. So then when it comes time to do their online check-in and they're sending you in their photos, you're going to pick up those things because you know that. You know what I mean?
Like
had that on the floor.
Yes, and you've had that visual and you can see the imbalances and you don't see them. And questions as well. Like sometimes asking them certain questions, it's just different altogether. Mm-hmm. How do you know what questions to ask them for a start?
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
And that's exactly right. You also then get to know, you know, the psychology of you know, a person's journey too. Because fitness isn't just about going to a gym and moving weights around. You know, you've got to consider the individualization of every single person that comes across your floor. And there's so many variables to that person. You know, what's their lifestyle like? What are their preferences like? What are their limitations? What are their challenges? What is their schedule like? Like, you know, are they a shift worker or not? And then with each of those individualisms come, you know, so many variables that you've got to work around to be able to get them to perform or adhere or be engaged in the process and commit to that journey of change, right? So I think unless you've gone through all of the ups and downs and highs and lows and roller coaster ride that you experience on that floor-based format with a client, then you lose a connection on the online. You can't build the connection online. And then how can you make the change? Like how can you get someone entrenched in that process
when
you don't have the face-to-face? Because then you don't even have the ability to converse with them.
That's right, and communicate. You have to be an excellent communicator, a really good coach. Like it doesn't matter. You get lots of these kind of like people online who like, you know, they know their stuff and they've got loads of degrees. And to be fair, they, you know, their knowledge is up there. But when it comes to communicating, you have to be excellent at communicating because the average person doesn't understand what, I don't know, the depression of the scapula means when you're doing a deadlift. If you just say, pull your shoulders back and down, lift your chest up. You know, these like simple cues where you just know, you've got to know how to communicate. And that was just a weird example. But I wanted to talk to you about also about the, you know, the side of like body dysmorphias and all that kind of stuff that people deal with. Because obviously you've been, I always say this, but, you know, haven't been critiqued against, you know, some of the finest physiques on the planet. I had a chat with, you know, James Alexander Ellis.
Yeah, yeah.
I had him in here yesterday. So we talked about this, but you must have gone through like different stages and chapters because you said, you know, it sounds like you started lifting weights for, you know, for the right reasons, really. You were already focused on strength and numbers, which is what I wish most people would focus on, because the performance and how you feel health-wise and stuff is the best markers, I would say, as opposed to just purely being focused on how you look, because that can be a slippery slope. But, yeah, how did you get on with your journey in that realm?
I think you really hit a nail on the head there where you said it's a slippery slope, and it really is, because, you know, I find that in this journey for a lot of women in particular, and I'm not going to say it doesn't happen with men because it definitely does, but the women tend to be, you know, the thing that we see more prevalent in this sort of situation is that they have this thing about defining their self-worth based upon, you know, a set of numbers, and those numbers, you know, are either going to be what's on the scale, or if they're in, you know, a powerlifting competition, it might be what numbers they're lifting from the floor, you know, and we see it happen all the time. And in particular, when it becomes about the scale, though, it becomes a really, really, really self-destructive process, because, you know, these scales can fluctuate. If you're in a process of recomposition, then you're going to be gaining lean tissue and you're going to actually perhaps go up or plateau in weight before you're coming down. It depends upon the phase you're in. It depends upon, you know, how much sleep you're getting, how much stress you've got, whether your sodium, like where your sodium levels are at. I mean, there's so many things that can create variations on those scales every single day of minus or positive of 3 kilos. Why would you define your entire worth about what that little number reflects? You know what I mean? But it happens. And, you know, I think that then there becomes that process of restriction and, you know, compensation of, well, if I do this today, I'm just going to work it out tomorrow, and I'm going to go train and run for, you know, however long to mitigate what I've just eaten, because I've eaten that because I'm not happy with myself because the scales didn't reflect that, or, you know, it's horrible, and it's a harsh reality, but we're seeing a lot of it. And what we see when we start to see disordered eating is that disordered eating, you know, isn't necessarily always just about, you know, starvation even. It can be about the thoughts about eating, the anxiety they get about, you know, prepping or not prepping. It can be about, you know, the way they're viewing themselves. It can be about, you know, the pressure they're putting on themselves with regards to, you know, social situations. They might be, you know, hiding themselves from social situations. I mean, there are so many things that, you know, sort of show the format of someone suffering from disordered eating. It's not just about, you know, restriction alone or starvation. There's so many cues. But it's sad, and I see it a lot. And I think first and foremost what I say to anyone is this, you know, if you're feeling that way, or you know you've got some of those behaviors, and, you know, some of the things we've talked about even just strike a bit of a chord with you, then I think that it's time to have a look at some of the reasons behind those feelings. You know, not looking at the validation externally or a specific number on a scale to give you the answer, because it's never found there. It's in much deeper stuff. You know, I always urge my clients to get to really the why. You know, the why they're doing things, the what makes them happy, the, you know, why they even feel like they need someone else's, you know, approval in the first place. And then start looking at some of those things and those triggers that can send them down those slippery slopes, because it usually comes back to such deeper stuff than just, you know, that number that they put everything on.
Definitely, yeah. And how did you take that? Talking about character building, how did you take it when, obviously, your first few shows you did with the Federation? And just regardless of that, I guess, when you've been told this area and that area needs to be developed more, and this needs to be improved and that needs to improve, right? Sure, because for me personally, when I didn't take it very well, I'm not going to lie. So I did my first show and I came second. I didn't even know anything really about nutrition and stuff then. Then I'd done the British finals and I didn't place anywhere. And I was just like angry afterwards, like, come on, what's wrong with these? I just didn't take it very well. I was acting up. And then I'd done another few shows, didn't place. And it hurt, because I was like, wow, put all that work in. And then like it felt like the guys whose physique wasn't as good as mine, but they had certain other things, like their posing was better and whatnot. And I just thought, wow, like, and I was just being like a little cool about it, basically. And then when I started doing WBFF, at that point, I built more resilience and I felt like I developed my character more. So talk to us a little bit more about the resilience and stuff that you've had to develop.
Yeah, I think you definitely need to, because you are looking essentially at yourself and picking yourself apart in a sense, you know, every single show. And look, I start doing it about now. So I don't wait till stage, and I don't wait till post stage, and I don't wait for the outcome on the stage. I'm already critically and constructively doing it to myself prior. So that then by the time I get to stage, I don't really think that there's anything anyone could say to me that would upset me, because I'm already anticipating what I think are going to be my zones anyway. And I have just a mindset of continual progression. Like, and I'm a big believer that, you know what, I'm never going to be perfect, but I'm going to strive to be the best version of myself. And that's all that really matters. So, you know, for me, I think the understanding that perfection is never going to come makes it sort of easier to understand that there's always going to be stuff to work on. And then I actively look out for it, you know, and I've reframed it now. And instead of it being something where I think my first year I was a bit like, far out, man. Like, wow, so much stuff to do. Whereas now I'm like, I'm excited by it. And that's actually for, and this is going to sound, you know, paradoxical, but it's true. If I did not have anything more to improve upon, I will no longer win a world title. End of story.
Yeah.
Someone's going to beat me.
Yeah.
End of story.
Yeah.
So it. I look at every single time I get on stage and I see a room for improvement as a very exciting thing because it means I've still got years in me. You know, I've still got the opportunity and the potential to continue to keep winning in me because I can keep improving. As long as I can match the gap and bring it up, then, you know, which I know I'll always do because I know that my work ethic's there. I know that my application's there. I know that I'm a practitioner of my craft, so I don't have to worry about that. As long as I'm not being, you know, unrealistic about what I'm setting out to do, I'll attain it. So for me, that I find it is an exciting thing, and I think the resilience comes because I have the capacity to have self-awareness about, you know, myself, but then also to reframe it, you know. And I think if you're in a situation where you feel like you are being judged like that, maybe try to look at it that way. Maybe instead of it being a potential negative with the things you're not yet, you know, be able to look at it and go, yeah, but these are the things that make me me, and these are my hallmark strengths. I'm going to play those right up, but then I'm just going to continue to get even better in these other zones.
Yeah.
And if I nail all of those, plus I'm awesome over here, then that's just going to make me pretty exceptional at the end of the day. And I think, you know, if you can look at it like that rather than pulling yourself apart only from the point of view of lack of, less than, not enough, I think you have a better frame set about it.
Yeah, that makes sense. Did you have that mindset at the start? Have you always been quite confident within yourself ever since you started competing? And
yeah. Look, I have actually. You know, I'm like everyone else though. Like the caveat to this, yes, incredibly confident about my abilities. I know what I'm capable of, and I know that, you know, I know that I can continue to be at the top for a long time. No issues with saying that, but I definitely am like everyone else. I have kryptonite and I do have moments of doubt, and I do have the comp brain moments. And Martin, you know what it's like when you'll be looking at yourself and you'll be like 2 weeks out and you're in the mirror and you're going, nah, there's jiggling there. That's not tight.
Oh, it's a constant battle.
You look constant at yourself. You look at the photo.
Pictures after the show, and you're like, oh my God, that was flawless.
I was dice.
Yeah.
I was shredded, like veins everywhere. What was I talking about? I have this one picture, right? Worlds before last, my 2017 Worlds in the UK. Christos and I always practice, well, we couldn't last year because I couldn't do my posing until midnight out, right? But normally we practice my posing in the peak week, and I get him to video me, and then we watch the video back. So, yeah, not last year, year before last was the last time we could do this. And on this one day, we're about 3 days out from the show, and I remember saying to him, because he would chuck little snippets of it up on Instagram and socials, just basically as a little feeder of what we were bringing to stage. Anyways, one day I was like, no, you cannot post that. My ass is dribbling. I'm not happy. The blah, 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 blah. Oh my God, Martin, I go back and I look at now, I had a full hamstring tie.
It's crazy, isn't it?
What was I thinking?
Yeah, because you're fragile mentally, as you said earlier, because your brain doesn't want to be there. It's doing everything in its power to get you out of that position. And then it's hard to stay, especially at that point, to stay really positive because you get to breaking point towards the end, don't you?
And you just don't see things as they are. You know, your perception can become very warped, and you've been inside your body every day critically analyzing yourself, and I think it becomes very hard then to be objective. And so, you know, I find that even now I have little days and little moments here and there. They're fleeting though, because you can, like I say, my self-awareness is really good, so I can pick myself up and I know I've done it. I'm like, I'm being an idiot, I'm moving on.
We're all good.
You know, but at the start, early in my career, that was much harder to do, and I definitely have more of those moments. But now, not as much. But I still get them, but just not as much.
Yeah, interesting. So, when I first started training, I was doing it because basically I was really enjoying it. And I, as you said, you know, that heyday when you first start lifting weights and you just stack the muscle on and you just literally you get addicted. And then obviously my journey took a bit of a different turn. Then I started competing, and then I started getting more attached to the aesthetics, and I was driven by aesthetics a bit more than the health side of it. I've always been connected with how it makes me feel mentally. Obviously, you always leave the gym feeling much better than what you did when you walked in pumped. The endorphins are rushing and all sorts. But a lot of people in this day and age, especially with the Instagram world, are driven purely by how they look, right? Mm-hmm. So they look in the mirror. Like, I get people come to me online and there's a trainer, and a lot of the time they're not happy with certain areas. They want to work on certain areas and improve certain parts of their body, right? So what advice would you give to people to, you know, because you said about the why. The why is so important with anything in life, right? So how do you go about that with people?
Look, I actually get them to look at the body as a, you know, performance vehicle. So, you know, we sort of, you know, pull it back, and instead of it being something where it's a particular body part, we look at the sum of the parts.
Mm.
And we start to look at, you know, okay, how is the infrastructure itself, you know, currently placed? Because usually, especially, okay, if we say for a female and they're wanting to work glutes and they're training, their glutes aren't activating properly, they're never actually going to grow them.
Mm.
So then we start looking at, well, okay, from a foundation point of view, is everything working right? Are we biomechanically sound? You know, is there any imbalances? What do we need to look at firing? Would you have any weak zones? And we start building the foundations in of creating this performance vehicle. And then, you know, we start creating goals that are not necessarily just about the aesthetic. Like, we try to get them checking in on and within themselves, checkpoints that are, you know, milestones that are not just about the physical, because, you know, as we've talked about before, it can become a very slippery slope if you're defining yourself only by an outcome or a number on the scale or, you know, a particular look. So I like to try to get them to focus on those things, and also, you know, the journey that you've got to go on to get there. So if we're going to build the, you know, the body part itself, understanding it's not going to happen overnight. It doesn't happen with one round of, you know, lifts, and it definitely doesn't happen from 1 4-week program. It's going to happen over the course of time. You know, so, you know, I definitely think you've got to be realistic. You've got to set realistic expectations, but you've got to make sure the body's moving right. Because a lot of the times, if someone's got a lagging body part, it's because they're not actually training it correctly.
That's right. The connection to the muscle, my muscle connection's
not there. They're actually not lifting it. They've got a secondary muscle group that's taking over from a primary lift. They've got a dominant body, you know, body part that's basically not allowing it to even activate. Like, so then you've got to start peeling back and correcting certain things, and then you've got to start firing up and turning on certain things, and then you know, can turn it all on together. But but I find that it's you've got to start at the beginning, break it back, look at the foundation, and then build upon that. But I still think it's really important that you've got them focused on, and I like to do this with my guys and girls, you know, goals that are both, yes, the body part we're working, but then performance based. So, you know, if we know that we've got to work you know, the glutes, and we're working out how to activate them, and where, you know, we've got a series of compounds, one of them might be, you know, the thrust as well as the squat and the dead, then it's, you know, working out where, how we're going to progressively load those, what that's going to look like, and get them chasing, you know, the progression inside the session rather than just the outcome of the physical.
The performance,
the performance space.
Definitely,
I think it's super important.
And you mentioned about the other markers as well. Like you said, you prioritize sleep, which is obviously something I always talk about. Is number one, I'd say it's the foundation for everything, because without, you know, having good quality sleep, everything else kind of goes to shit in a way anyway. So so it's paying attention to the other markers, like how you sleep in, you know, how's your energy levels, how's your skin, all these things are good markers of, you know, optimal health, right? So I think, as you said about performance, and that is some advice I give to people, is just to really focus on. And I think one of the main benefits from lifting weights is the is connecting with your body. I think, for example, like you said then, when you really, I would say it's at least 70-80% psychological lifting weights, you know, because you see people in the gym and they're just doing reps, and they're not, you can see they're not focused on technique at all. But if you get, like, for example, when you started doing squats again, and you got a decent amount of weight on your back to do a squat, you know, you have to channel in and you have to connect with your body. So I think that's one of the main benefits is connecting with your body, with lifting weights. And so I was going to say, in, you know, we're coming towards the end now, but I was going to say, do you have any advice for the listeners who are just looking, because you said you've been lifting weights for 18 years, right? I've been at it for about 16, 17. So, you know, just for the listeners, you know, like, it doesn't happen overnight, right?
Yeah,
so,
no.
Yeah.
I think it's funny, because I think everyone always looks at you and goes, oh, she's just become a success overnight, like literally just come out of nowhere. And I'm like, no, you know, my business is 12 years running. You know, I've been lifting weights for 18 years. I've been a competitive athlete and a professional athlete now for 6 nearly, and a competitive athlete for, you know, over half my life.
Yeah, so consistency is important.
So consistency and understand it takes time. You know, like, you do not develop big, thick muscle bellies overnight. You do not develop the maturity in muscle that creates the conditions to have those striations in your legs and everywhere else overnight. It happens with time.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, and especially if you're a natural athlete, it takes a long time. So, you know, like, I think people just need to, really understand that It's something that is going to require hard work, consistency, and honestly, patience.
You know, that's a big one, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Definitely. I'd always say they're the main three: patience, discipline, and consistency. Yeah. But it's falling in love with the process. I think it's like anything in life. You know, you come across people who are billionaires and they're miserable, right? Well, I haven't come across those people. Don't get me wrong. I'm not living that life. But you know what I mean?
They're definitely out there.
Because they're chasing that end goal, but they realize then,
I haven't seen people inside the fitness industry. I haven't seen professional athletes where I'm like, wow, you know, like, I think you've done this for all the wrong reasons. Like, you know, this isn't your joy. You're not living your purpose when you're doing this, and it really probably should have just stayed a hobby for some of them. But you know, and I find it sad because again, it's just that whole trying to do something that fits inside of, you know, conforming to a stereotype, right? Whereas I think that in anything, if you can find your true passion in it, then that's where you'll find the best success, the fastest results, the most, you know, fulfillment. And, you know, fitness is no different. So it doesn't have to be about a stage for you. It could be about going and doing CrossFit. It could be about going and doing MMA or jiu-jitsu. It could be about, you know, going running. You could become the next marathoner, like whatever it is. But find it. You could be a yogi and just be loving every single day doing it. And that's still going to be giving you a life of optimal health.
I think purpose, because they've done studies recently. I don't think I'm going to try and quote these studies, but there was one done in Japan recently. I don't know exactly how they've done these, but they found that the people who admitted to having like more purpose in their life, whether that's having kids, that's another one as well. They found people who had kids tend to live a longer, healthier life, because that's an extreme version of like purpose in your life, right? But they find that, you know, people who have purpose tend to, you know, like the blue zones, I don't know if you've mentioned this before.
Yeah.
Yeah, they all seem to have that purpose, right? So that's an important thing you were saying about fulfillment, right?
Yeah, definitely. And look, and I think, you know, as I said before, that's what led me to leave, you know, the corporate realm and come into this full time, because, you know, this really was for me where I found it was my blue zone. Like, it was 100%, you know, my passion, my purpose, and where I found Zen, you know. And I think a lot of the times the things that you think you should be doing in life aren't necessarily the things that bring you the most joy.
Yeah, that's it. That's right. And I've been lifting weights for, like I said, 16 years in terms of training. You've been doing it for 18 years, right? So where was I going to go with that? And I kind of lost my train of thought. It's like I'm just trying to brag now. No, I was going to say.
I just feel like all of a sudden we sound really old.
I know. Really, I'm like, where did that time go? It's like I was 15 when that happened. No, but obviously we've done it naturally, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, this day and age now, there's a lot of people taking performance enhancing stuff, right? Before we wrap it up, we've got you know, one or two more things. But what's your experience with people who have gone over to the dark side? Especially, you know, I've come across women. I've had to kind of help them rebuild metabolism and stuff like that from where they've overdone, certain things.
And look, I think we'd be foolish to believe that it's not there, because it's actually, you know, incredibly mainstream now, almost, which is, you know, it's so different to what it was when I first started.
Different world.
I had to learn. It was like learning a whole nother freaking language to understand what people were talking about. And actually, funny story, it just happened to me yesterday. Paolo and I were in the car, and Paolo asked me something, and I've gone, I have no idea what that is. Let me Google it. And it was a performance enhancing, you know, substance. And I'm like, oh my God, okay, well, we're just both learning.
There's so many out there now, see, isn't there? You hear of all these random words.
Exactly. Yeah. And it was that process of like, holy wow, like there's so much we don't know. But look, I'm at that place where I used to be so anti it, wouldn't dream of coaching anyone that was on it, blah, blah, blah. And then I got to the point where I was like, I'm an idiot if I believe that the rest of the planet is going to be natural for life, because they're not.
Exactly.
So I had to get to this place where I was like, right, I'm going to be that mother that lets their kids drink as long as they're inside the house and I've bought the alcohol so I know what they're doing, who's here, and they're safe. You know, so it was like that.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, and they're not all doing it. I'd probably say maybe 10-20% in total that I've got at any point in time throughout our team that want to.
And that's women as well, obviously.
Men and women,
yeah.
And so,
do you think it's worse for women to take it generally, like, or does it depend how sensibly you do it?
I think it all comes down to that, right? So my biggest thing was when I became that mother hen of, right, you're gonna drink safely inside of my premise. It was a case of, right, you're going to the doctor and you're getting your blood work done. First and foremost. And then secondly, you're going to be dealing with said doctor or a professional in what you're gonna be doing.
Mm.
Because there's so much shady backdoor stuff. It's like, it's quite scary, right? Mm. So the process of that, I think, you know, look, my preference is always that people are probably erring on the side of caution when it comes to this stuff.
Mm.
But definitely, if you're going to go down that route, be safe and be tested and see a specialist and, you know, do it with informed decision-making.
Mm.
Don't be like me and Googling a car to find out what the hell something is.
Yeah,
like,
exactly. What the hell is that?
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
don't Google something and be like, okay, now I know everything about it. Because guess what? You have no freaking idea.
Never trust a Google, man. It's dangerous.
Google is not an endocrinologist, okay? Yeah, so,
exactly.
Like, maybe go see someone.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. Yeah, one more thing then, I guess. I just wanted to talk about mental health quickly and just health in general, overall wellness, and a little bit on aesthetics as well. Just what you do, because obviously you mentioned gratitude and meditation. I always talk about that on the podcast. Gratitude is something I swear by. Meditation is something I dip in and out of, and I kind of use the breathing techniques to help me when I'm stressed. But what do you do to keep on top of your mental health and keep and any recommendations you have? Because I'm guessing you've come across people who have suffered with mental health, because it's an epidemic right
now.
So any tips you have would be
definitely
great.
Definitely. And you know, the irony of this right now is the fact that I just finished going on my social media and my Instagram.
Oh yeah, I saw that earlier. I wanted to bring that up actually. Yeah.
And
talk to us.
Talked about the fact that I have never suffered depression before ever, and I don't like to label things. I don't like when people get behind that label and everything in life is about that and that's who they are, because it's not something that's not curable, and it's not something that's, you know, you can work through those things, right? And so me being self-aware, pulled myself up within 2 weeks. It's literally only been the last 2.5-3 weeks, right? So immediate thing was, okay, there's actually something going on. I'm feeling flat and I'm feeling down.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never felt down before. But I had to turn to my fiance and be like, okay, we need to just sit down and have a chat, because like, I don't really know what's going on, and I'm feeling these are things I'm feeling.
Sorry, since you never felt down before, what you mean is this down, you mean this low?
Actually, like, and this is going to sound corny, but actually never felt down. I've
really?
Actually never had a period in my life where I've been like bluesy.
All right, so you've had your bad day and stuff, but not long periods.
I have a bad day.
Yeah, that's all right then.
I have road rage. Like, come on. But I've never had the blues. I've never had melancholy. I've never had a period where I've lost socialization and felt antisocial, or I felt like I can't connect, or like I just don't even want to be on my social media. You know what I mean? Like, I've never felt that before. So my immediate thing when this happened in the last 2 or 3 weeks, when it has happened, was, okay, is this prep related? Is this to do with me going into a deficit? How's my energy balance? What am I looking at? So I looked at, you know, we did the numbers and we checked everything out. No, it's not any of those things. So then my next thing is, okay, is it something that's maybe related to gut health? Is it something that I'm eating? Am I sensitive to something? Am I stressed? And is it an unobserved, unidentified level of stress? Is there pressure or stress that I'm just not really aware of, subconsciously going on? Is there a workload issue? Which there's not, because I've actually tapered back. So when I'm addressing these things in conversation now, it's probably for the listeners to take home. These are things I'd be looking at. So if you are feeling a little oppressed or overwhelmed, start looking at these things. Okay, can I adjust my work schedule? Is it a work schedule problem? Is it a personal problem? Is it in a relationship context? Is there disconnect for me somewhere and I'm feeling not connected, which then makes me feel a little unstable? Am I well nutritioned? Are my calories right? Am I overtraining? Am I under eating? Those are the next things. And then lastly for me, which is what I think it came down to, was a point of, I have started to forget to do my parasympathetic stuff because I've been so busy in life.
Wow. So by that, you mean the gratitude and meditation
stuff?
Yes. Wow.
So I turned around and I was like, right, you know what? I haven't been doing these things for like 6 weeks. And it's been 6 weeks, but in a point where all of a sudden I've had an adjustment in my life where calories have come down. I'm doing my graduate diploma in performance nutrition. So, you know, the high stakes and really heavy levels of study, and then, you know, managing my team and doing my own prep and, you know, just everything going on, right? So I think at all of those points in time, the one thing my body probably needed was to have those parasympathetic inputs 100%. That are calming my central nervous system, which is then putting me in an ability to respond and cope to things better day to day. Because these little things we're about to talk about, like the things I do in the morning, walking the chocolates, I meditate, I do the breathing techniques, and then I actually do at different times during the day, if I need to, you know, jump into something. It might be expressive writing just to get something out.
Like journaling kind of thing.
Yeah. So I'm really big on responding, not reacting. So if I feel any kind of release in me that might be a reaction, I just take myself away from the situation.
But that takes practice. That comes from meditation and gratitude, mainly, would you say?
100% does. I give gratitude in the morning for the top three things I'm grateful for in the morning when I wake. But then I set the intention for the next day too, at the end of the night, where I'll actually give gratitude for the things that happened in that day.
Mm.
So, you know, what's made me smile in the day. Something as simple as that, you know, actually has a great benefit. But then the things I've learned in the day, or the things that I'm, you know, probably most grateful that I've had exposure to, you know, that perhaps might be new for me. So that might be a challenge.
Yeah.
This is the other thing, is when I talk about reframing, it's looking at something that might be difficult that you've been able to turn into a positive too.
Mm.
And this is the thing, right? I've gone through 6 weeks of not doing that. So not channeling my
6 weeks, wow, that's a long time,
into positives, right?
Yeah.
And I'm used to doing that. So I think...
So interesting that.
Mm. So for the last 3 days, I've just been straight back into those habits. I've got my habit tracker on my phone. I've got my gratitude journal on my phone. Guys, you can download these things. There's apps for this.
Mm.
So, you know, don't feel like everything is in your phone. We're always all on our phone. Why not, instead of scrolling mindlessly and numbingly through a feed that does not fill your soul, why don't you go into something that does and start looking at a ritual or a meditative state or a podcast or a journal that feeds you, right?
Yeah.
So I just didn't give back to myself enough in the last, you know, 6 weeks. And I think that I've paid a little bit for that, you know, like
absolutely.
My body's gone, I'm going to drop you down a gear and put you on your ass.
It's a signal, isn't it?
Lifting me up.
Definitely. So, think about your hormones, isn't it? Because like, it's been proven with meditation, it changes like the gray matter in the brain, and the serotonin levels increase and the cortisol. So your stress hormones are probably through the roof, and now obviously you maybe have balanced it out now. So goes to show, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I'm definitely working on it, and even just in the last 3 days I can already feel, you know, a shift. So you can't discount these things. They're amazing. And I think, you know, people will go, I can't meditate, it's too hard. That's because it's a skill that's built over consistent application.
Just like building your body, you've got to train your mind. It's the most important tool, isn't it?
We talked before, preparation for a show, it's mental, not physical. Train your mind. You want to be a champion, train your mind. If you want to be able to create change in your body and in your life, train your mind. Feed your soul.
How long do you spend meditating? Last question now.
Literally, anyone else starting out should do 2 to 5 minutes max.
That's what I do.
That's all you should do, right? I go for 10-minute bursts, and then at night I actually have, especially when I've got a busy mind or if there's a heavy workload on with my study, I'll put on, there's a couple of guys download an app called Breathe, B-R-E-E-T-H-E. It's amazing. There are actually sleep hypnosis ones that are phenomenal. They're 30 minutes to an hour long. I fall asleep in them.
Wow.
Every single time I put my AirPods on and I'm snoring.
I go with the show. That's amazing. That's awesome. Some great tips there. Yeah, the only thing I do regret about this podcast is actually not getting a spray tan beforehand, because I'm looking at the video, I'm thinking I might just delete this video. I just look so white. It's just a joke. look it back over to Alicia. Look how brown she is compared to me. It's not fair.
This is me white. He's like, okay, you can go now.
I'm done. Now, awesome. It's time to go and get a steak then, now with our partners. Yes. Let's call it a day. Thanks a lot for your time, Alicia. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Mum. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks.